Accession number 13917, Mrs. A.V. Mason, reel 3.
Press the identity.
Okay. Did you have any sort of idea of what, you know, the regime in Iraq was like, how it compared to that in Jordan? In Jordan, it was obviously a very personal matter, wasn't it?
I don't think I can really answer that. I felt that there was even more intrigue in Iraq. I was quite glad that we were posted to Amman and not to Baghdad after our visit to Baghdad, although it was a marvelous one.
Why was that?
Well, I think that Amman was a some pleasanter place. Again, a mother speaking with three small children. The climate was better. And when your children are, three of them are under seven or whatever it was, you're very aware of what the atmosphere is like for your children.
You were saying that you thought that for your children it was better to be in Amman than in...
Yes, I was... this is a very personal observation, but I was very glad that I was bringing my children up in a better climate. Also, we had great freedom to move around in Jordan, and I wasn't quite sure whether we'd have the same freedom to move around. I don't know why. I think to bring... To go on a trip, for example, down to the Marsh Arabs would be very tough and very hard. We had Jerusalem, Arab Jerusalem. We had Jericho. We had the Dead Sea. We had lots of places to visit, things to do, not only biblical sites to see, but lovely places to see. Jerash, for example, Petra, Aqaba, which was a little tiny port. They seemed to be... it was a good place for us, with our small children, to be at that time, better than Baghdad. And this is, again, as a mother speaking, not a diplomat.
Now you're speaking about the implementation of the contingency plan to send British forces into Jordan, Operation Fortitude, they called that eventually. Now, around about this time, there were a lot of contingency plans, because general staff spend their time writing these things when they're not actually carrying on operations.
Right.
For interventions in Lebanon, in Jordan, in Kuwait, Oman, Sudan, Libya, and so forth, all based upon forces which would have come through Cyprus. Was your husband aware of those?
Oh, yes. I'm certain he was. I'm certain he would have been aware of them, yes. I mean, I don't know in how fine detail all of the contingency plans, but I'm certain he was aware of them all. I mean, I hardly ever saw him at that time simply because he was working so late and in the days before the fax machine, it was telegrams coming and going all the time.
Now, as you say, he was in charge when the force arrived, the parachute brigade.
Yes.
Parachute brigade minus one battalion.
Yeah.
Do you know how much warning he had that it was on the way?
My husband?
Yes.
I'm hesitating because I don't know. I'm guessing. Would it have been 24 hours, 36 hours? I mean, a very short notice, I know that. Because once this had happened, again, the atmosphere was tense. I don't think there were riots. Or were there? There might have been. Yes, there were riots, I'm sorry. Very quickly they could be calling for King Hussein's blood, and there really wasn't much to stop. The crowds, except the Bedouin soldiers, now did. I think they probably had moved up to the palace at that stage with tanks. and to protect their king. But if there had been a tremendous surge, there was nothing much to protect the palace. The king could have gotten in a plane or a helicopter and gone somewhere else, I don't know. But we were living next door to the palace. And it was I felt very exposed at that time. I know my family in America were wild with worry. And they sort of subsequently asked, what did I do? And I said, well, you have children, you have breakfast, allowances, lunch, tea, supper, you have to sort of, life does go on, and you sort of apply yourself as calmly as you can to doing what you, doing your routine things, simply to keep everything stable. Your own servants, whom we had, and you wanted to keep them placid, and I think we did. But as soon as we knew that they were on their way, I must say that personally, and I think that everybody in the foreign community felt an enormous sense of relief that you know, something was being done and that they were going to save this poor little country. The first thing that happened, and it was a matter of hours after the first planes came in, was that the Land Rover came up the hill to our house with a two-way radio in it. And they left a radio with me and taught me how to use it. The hello one, and Roger and out business. And I had to report twice a day to the RAF base where they were headquartered that we were all okay. And indeed, if we weren't okay, I was supposed to report. There was somebody apparently monitoring this at the other end all the time. So that became for, I don't know how many weeks, a daily part of my life, to report in the morning, report in the evening, that we were okay.
A situation report.
A situation report, that's right. Sit rep. And I'd never had anything like this before, but it gave me a degree of comfort, although I couldn't really make this damn thing work very well, but it was something. The whole compound of the British Embassy, our house and the palace, was surrounded by tanks. And I think they were the Arab Legion then. Or were they... Yes, because... And I think there... Yes, for a little while there was a tank sitting in front of the British Embassy, which was in front of our drive also. Terribly exciting for our children. But it did... I don't know, it was a sign of something was there to protect us. As a result of one of the earlier riots, we had iron bars put on our downstairs windows. A horrible thought. And as you know, we all do when things were quiet, we just left the iron bars open. There was a sort of door. But we were told in no uncertain terms to live with them shut. You could open the doors inside, but leave these iron bars on and shut them. Which really isn't very comforting, but there we were. That was the best they could do at the time. So it was right away after the troops arrived, the atmosphere, well, it changed, it quietened.
So they had a tranquilizing effect.
It had very much of a tranquilizing effect. And I think particularly on the king. Now, I don't know about Queen's Anne. I didn't see her at all at that time. I think they thought that there was the support which they perhaps didn't dare hope for, so that they lived through this crisis. They were an enormous, I think, help to the whole situation. In other words, they saved... Save Jordan at this time.
At the time, the king was anxious to receive support from as many quarters as possible, and he was appealing for British help, but also for an American force to
come in
into Jordan to show solidarity.
I didn't know that. I didn't know he'd also asked for American troops to come. I didn't know that, but there we are.
And he was rather surprised, I think, because the United States had been supporting him financially, taken over from the United Kingdom, and the United Kingdom became unpopular, and yet the United States was very reluctant to have anything to do with the idea of putting a force into Jordan. Did you pick up any echoes of that?
No, but it's the first I've heard that it even wanted American troops to come in. It's in a funny sort of way, it just seems so obvious that British troops would come in.
Well, the British government was very anxious to get an American involvement as well, because they were afraid of being isolated,
as they
had been at the time of Suez.
Yeah.
And I think they felt that a purely British force might be misinterpreted as a return to
semi-colonialism. Yes. I don't think anybody on the ground took that seriously. There was no. I think that the officers who commanded this were exemplary in making their diplomatic overtures, and very sensitive to what the feelings might be. And my memories are of an operation which was extremely sensitively handled and very well handled with the locals.
Well, it was very much the case that the Brigadier Pearson, was told before he set off that he was to act only in accordance with instructions and advice from the British Embassy. So, in effect, your husband would have been in command of the British forces, Jordan.
Yes.
But they were there for essentially a political and diplomatic and not a military purpose.
Yeah. I mean, a thousand pities that he isn't here to tell you about this, because these are things which. I mean, in those days, it was such a different atmosphere. A wife was a wife, and you didn't discuss. I mean, we discussed a lot, but things which were okay to discuss. And the other thing one must remember is that the place, every time there is any sort of upset, the journalists came crawling down to Amman, usually from Beirut. And they would make a beeline for any embassy wife they could possibly find who might spill any beans after a drink or two. And so it was probably just as well that I think that there was protection all around, that we weren't privy to anything too sensitive diplomatically or politically.
Did you ever hear that there was a possible notion of the Jordanian army going to Baghdad to try and
No, I never heard that. Was it ever discussed seriously? I'm quite amazed if it was.
Difficult to know how seriously it was put forward, but one time there was an idea that
I wonder whose idea it was.
Well, it said that the king had the idea of sending two brigades down through Habaneer and into Baghdad to quell the mutiny and to rally loyal formations of the Iraqi army to the Hashemite standard, and that Sharif Nasser was 100 miles inside Iraq at the time the British force was flying in. I don't know if you heard anything at all.
No, this is the first I've heard of that. I mean, I think it would have been disastrous anyway. Mm. I mean, again, the benefit of hindsight. But I didn't know that at all. I'm very glad it didn't happen.
The actual coup. The coup in Iraq seems to have come as a complete surprise to the officials in London and also in Jordan. And at first they didn't know what was going on. And the reports from the RAF station at Habaneer said that the Iraqis there were quite friendly and showed no signs of being hostile. At the same time, the British embassy in Baghdad was being attacked. So I think there was the notion that perhaps only a small element in the Iraqi armed forces were involved in the coup, and that they might have been dealt with by a counter coup.
But, very likely, I don't know. But then again, alas, the Arabs, when they're excited and incited, are very easily led. And the fact that the Iraqis in Habaneer were very friendly with their British counterparts, I'm not in the least surprised. While the British embassy was being sacked, there's very much something about the heat of the moment. You know, if somebody's throwing a stone, you're out to pick up a stone and throw it too, unless you're a saint. And
it's fun, isn't it?
How small the group was who actually murdered Nuri Pasha and murdered the king, I don't know. I think it was suspected that it was quite a small nucleus of malcontents. And as I said earlier, the fact that nobody knew, or the fact that people ignored funny little signs and whispers, was quite extraordinary. I suppose we're all guilty of this at times. I mean, you think, oh, well, that's not really true. You do hear rumours and counter-rumours all the time. But this was serious, and nobody took any precautions whatsoever.
Well, there was quite a prevalent notion, certainly in the Foreign Office at the time, that if there was trouble in Jordan, possibly even in Lebanon, then the Iraqi armed forces might be counted upon to help sort it out as a local ally and as the leading Arab, well, as the only Arab member of the Baghdad Pact.
Right, that's right, I forgot the Baghdad Pact, yes.
So the main prop of expectation would be kicked away if people accepted that the Iraqi army wasn't reliable.
Wasn't reliable, yes, yeah.
So it was all very complicated.
Yeah, very complicated, and again, I wish I could throw more light on that, but I can't, only sort of what I picked up.
Another thing that happened was that when the British force to Jordan were dispatched, it all happened very quickly. The parachute brigade was sent out from London to Cyprus, and shortly after that they were sent on. And there was a problem arose because they set off to fly to Amman by the direct route, and although the first two or three aircraft arrived with the brigade commander and some members of the brigade, those following on were turned back by the Israelis who
I remember there was a yes, I do, two or three planes and then a long gap.
Well, this is a problem because it was thought in London that the Israelis had consented to overfly it.
Yeah.
But in actual fact, the Israeli air traffic control claimed that they hadn't been given orders to allow it, and they ordered the main body of aircraft to turn back, which most of them did. Do you remember hearing anything about that?
I mean, it's such a significant thing. I wish I could tell you more, but again, I do remember, memory is a funny thing, but I do remember that there were two or three planes which came, we all were so heartened, and then a blank.
Yes.
And I can't remember how long that blank went on for. Was it hours or was it a day?
Well, it was most of a day.
And then they came at night, perhaps.
They flew in overnight and were landing the next morning, yes.
But I mean, I didn't know about the Israeli air traffic controllers sort of blocking this. I'm not in the least bit surprised. But I didn't know about it. I mean, I would have thought they'd fly in over Lebanon. Well, no, perhaps they couldn't. That would mean Syria.
Well, they might have had to fly over Syrian territory, and they didn't want to do that because Syria was then part of the UAR.
That's right,
that's right. It would have been
considered
an act of war against UAR, which included Egypt, so that was all rather messy.
Yes.
And as I say, Macmillan believed that he'd personally cleared the idea of overflight with Ben-Gurion and Golda Meir, and then was rather taken aback when he found that the Israeli Air Force was ordering transport aircraft to go back to Cyprus.
No, I remember this gap, and possibly at the time when one did know, but I don't have a significant memory of this, but I remember also being aware of the very exposed position of the few men who had come.
Yes.
There they were, all by themselves, without any follow-up at all.
Do you know if the Jordanians were expecting them at all, the Jordanian army, the Bedouin?
Oh, they must have been. They must have been. I don't know, but I would have been very surprised if it had been just sort of sprung on them.
Well, the king certainly requested help and was very pleased to hear it was coming, but there is an impression in some quarters that the news hadn't got down to the Jordanian army and that they...
I find that very difficult to believe, because there was no resistance at all. I think that they would have resisted, or perhaps they felt they were too weak. I'm sure that the Jordanian army must have been informed of this. Don't forget that the Jordanian army, the core, the hardcore of them, were Bedouins, and they would have welcomed it. In fact, they might have had chums who were coming with the parachute regiment. British trained, British led, until relatively recently. They must have known.
Now, after the the arrival of the brigade, the two battalions and so on, they set up a perimeter around the airfield. Did you ever go down to the airfield at Oman and see anything of it while they were there?
Well, yes, we used to go swimming every Sunday. There was a swimming pool in the RAF base, and we were invited to swim every Sunday, any foreigner. Yes, we went. The base, you see, had been an RAF base. It looked busy, buzzing. It was all right. So I saw the base from the vantage place of a swimming pool.
I was wondering if you'd actually seen any of the defensive positions there.
No, I can't help you there at all. Nope.
Another thing about the arrival, before I forget it, is that around about the time they were due to arrive, some American aircraft flew over Amman as a gesture of solidarity. Do you remember anything about
that? I don't remember
that
at all. Don't remember that at all. Wish I had.
Well, they were actually mistaken for Soviet or Syrian aircraft, which was rather alarming. But were
they shot at or?
No, they weren't. It just caused a certain amount of apprehension. But I think the American idea was they didn't want to put ground troops into Jordan because the line of communication was uncertain and they had certain political doubts about British motives.
Yes.
But they wanted to give some sign of solidarity and support, so they made this overflight as a gesture.
Yes. No, I don't remember that at all.
The other thing is that they, besides wanting to hold the airport for obvious reasons, because it was their main line of communication.
Yes.
And just to actually be there as a presence to reassure the Jordanian government, there were various plans for protection of key points like Palace Hill.
Yes.
And for the evacuation of certain categories of people.
Yeah.
From Amman in certain circumstances. Did you hear anything about those?
I do remember being reassured that if anything terrible happened, that now that the troops were here, we'd be okay. We'd be looked after, taken care of. But it wasn't spelled out as to how. Mm. And once the troops were there, I didn't occur to me to find out how, because it felt all right.
And you had your radio.
And I had my two-way radio. I was the only one who did, because everybody else lived in the other part of Amman and weren't quite so exposed.
Do you know if anyone gave them a means of communication so they could call for help?
No, I don't think any of them had. I was the only one who had the radio. Because they all lived in another part of Amman and quite close to each other. Mm. So that I think it was felt that because we were so isolated, we ought to have a radio.
And you're close to the centre as well.
I'm pretty close to the centre. Yeah. And I had to go through the centre to get anywhere. We very quickly we began to see paratroops in the town, and with their scooting around, not taking up positions, but scooting around their Land Rovers, doing errands. And as far as I know, people looked at them sort of quizzically, but not with great hatred. And then got used to them, as one does to anything.
That's quite interesting, because one time General Templer came out.
Yes, he did.
Do you remember seeing him?
Yes, I do, indeed. I can't tell you anything more. I know he came out.
You didn't meet him?
I did meet him.
You did?
Yes. But I can't tell you what he talked about, because exactly why he was there. Was it then, or was it previously that he came out?
He'd come out earlier as well on a mission to try and persuade King Hussein not to break off the British connection and to keep
join
the Baghdad Pact.
That was it, and he came back at that time.
Yes, he came back.
I knew that he'd come earlier.
Yes.
Again, I don't quite know why he came out. I mean, it just seems a normal thing that he'd come.
Well, he was chief of the Imperial General Staff.
Well, yes.
And he was having a look.
Having a look-see.
Yes. Mm. But he said when he got back to England that he didn't think it was right for the airborne brigade at Amman to be unobtrusive and just sit on the airfield. He thought that they ought to show themselves more by driving around the capital.
How interesting.
In military convoys as a sort of show of strength. Did you hear anything about that?
No, I didn't hear anything about it. But, I mean, since the day they arrived, they seem to be out and about.
Mm.
Not in a great sort of scary way. Convoy, no. I don't think I ever saw one, or maybe one or two, but certainly you would see them in the, you know, a couple of Land Rovers going to get vegetables at the market sort of thing.
Yes.
And also, if you're going to ask me whether they were outside of Amman, I don't know. Because at that time, I don't think during the crisis, we didn't go out of Amman.
Well, there weren't very many of them, a couple of battalions, and if the worst case had arisen, one of those battalions would have held the airfield,
yes,
and the other one would have gone into Amman to extract
various people
who need to be evacuated.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Templar's idea that the British force ought to be making more of a show of strength was disputed both by the embassy and also by Pearson and the local command on the ground, who felt they'd got it about right in terms of the
I would have thought so. I would have thought so, having you know, memory coming back now.
Yes.
They certainly were seen in the town, but not in a great show of strength.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the man on the ground, the person on the ground, is aware of the subtleties and the nuances better than somebody who's made a flying visit.
Yeah.
I think that was very right.
Mm-hmm. I got this line very strongly actually from a chap called Nigel Bromage.
Oh, yes, I know we're not Nigel, yes. Mm-hmm. Which line did you get from him? That did he want the show of strength?
No, he thought the show of strength would have been a disaster.
I think he's totally right.
It would have created resentment.
And indeed.
There wasn't sufficient strength.
It would have exacerbated the problem. And as it was, I think it was handled with delicacy and tact and all the rest.
You mentioned the tranquility, a sense of tranquilization and calm arriving once the British force had arrived. It does seem that in Cyprus, towards the end of July and in early August, it was felt that there might be an attack on the troops on the airfield, possibly coming from disaffected Jordanian units at Zirka. And there was an agitation within the British chain of command to reinforce the forces with tanks on the grounds that some of the Jordanian armoured regiments were not reliable. I don't know if you heard anything about that.
I didn't hear anything about it at all, but I certainly remember British tanks.
Oh, there were no British tanks.
Well, what was parked outside the ambassador's residence?
Well, it might have been a Jordanian tank.
No, it was a British one. It had British troops in it.
Really? That's the first I've heard.
A tank. It looked like, I'm not up on, maybe it was a very highly armoured car. It looked like a great big huge vehicle.
Did it have wheels or tracks?
No, it had treads.
Tracks.
Tracks.
Well, there were no British tanks in Jordan in 1958 because there had been some. There had been a cavalry regiment in the south, north of Aqaba. They'd been withdrawn. There was pressure to send a squadron of the Royal Tank Regiment from Cyprus or from Libya out to reinforce, but the argument against was that by the time they arrived, a month would have gone by. And
yeah,
it would be too late.
It'd be too late anyway
to do anything, and it would be very expensive to supply them.
Yeah.
And if there was going to be an attack with armour, the best answer to that would be from the RAF half squadron that was there, the six hunters. However, one keeps coming across rumours that the British forces in Jordan actually borrowed tanks from the Jordanians.
Well, possibly. Possibly this was a borrowed tank. Yes. I don't know.
Have you no idea what type of tank it was?
I'm sorry. I'm hopeless on this.
You haven't done the course on recognition.
I haven't done the course on recognition at all, but it certainly had tracks on it.
Yes.
But there was a British crew in.
A British crew?
A British crew.
Outside the embassy?
Yeah. No, yes, outside the embassy. This is up on the hill.
Sounds like a case of borrowing. I know
it might have been borrowing then.
They borrowed jeeps and other things from the Jordanian army.
Yeah.
Because afterwards the financial administrators had a lot of trouble sorting out who owned what and whether
that's right. Who will
should be paid for?
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, that's terribly interesting. I hadn't heard that before.
Yeah.
What they did actually, they did reinforce, not with armour, because although Cyprus was in favour, GHQ Cyprus was in favour, GHQ Middle East, British Defence Council, Coordination Council Middle East was in favour. In London, the feeling was no, this is not a good idea. They sent some artillery. They sent a battery of 25-pounders. I don't know if you remember them turning up at
No,
at all.
Don't remember them being fired or anything at all. Well, they might have been ringing. They might have ringed the airfield.
Well, they sent them in from Akbar, and they would have been used to support the paras on the airfield from within the perimeter if they'd been needed. But in fact, the only shooting they did was some demonstration shooting for the Jordanian army when things were much better.
Yeah.
They were really helping to train them a bit.
Yes.
The other thing is that the Cameroonians arrived. I don't know if you remember meeting any of them. They came from Kenya via Aden, went in through Akbar, and then eventually they turned up at the airfield and did some digging and.
I have no memory.
Yes.
No memory at all.
No memory of the Cameroonians.
No.
What a
shame.
Regiment. Yes.
Yeah.
And that was it. Apart from the air force, I suppose you must have been. Seen the hunters fly.
Oh yes. So they were, you know, a fine sight, and they made a lot of noise, and they were very much there. Anybody, you know, within miles around could have seen and heard them.
Mm.
So they made a presence, a much better sort of show of force than making a huge parade in the town of military hardware.
Yes. Well, you can't stone an aeroplane.
No, you can't. And I mean, also you feel rather helpless against it.
Yes.
And so, they were flying around all the time. I don't know what they were doing, but they were flying around.
I think they were just showing themselves.
Well, possibly, yeah.
Now, again, the overflight question.